Hello, and welcome back to the Gene Wolfe Literary Podcast by Clay Temple Media. I'm Glenn McDorman.
And I'm Brandon Buddha. Today we'll be continuing our coverage of Gene Wolfe's novella, The Eye Flash Miracles. Today is our fourth recap episode, and if you're reading along with us in The Island of Dr. Death and Other Stories and Other Stories, we'll be covering up to page 325. I forget what page we're starting on, but hopefully you're not joining us in the second to last recap episode.
Yeah, just listen in order, and you'll be fine. Before we get into it, we've got actually a fairly large announcement to make here, which is that we have started two new extra holiday series on Patreon. A big feature of our Patreon feed is that in addition to the monthly bonus episodes that everybody gets at certain levels, we also have access to our holiday episodes. This includes a Christmas episode and Halloween episode, and also a Remembrance Day episode. And, you know, we do different things with these. Our Remembrance Day episode is really where we cover military speculative fiction. It's, you know, mostly been military science fiction, I guess, that we've covered there so far. But we're adding two new holidays to this roster. We're going to be doing episodes for Easter and episodes for Earth Day. Easter just seemed to be a good springtime holiday for covering some religious speculative fiction, which, hey, we're doing now, though this has actually been, you know, really kind of the first time we've done this in a long time. It was something that I've really been quite missing. So I've started that bonus series there. It'll be an annual series. And then for Earth Day, going to be covering environmental speculative fiction. There's maybe a little bit of that here, but not as much as we have had in other Gene Wolfe stories. And frankly, this religious speculative fiction, environmental speculative fiction as well, these were two things that we got so much of in very early Gene Wolfe that I have been missing. And so we have started these new series just this spring. This year's episodes are out now. We've covered some Arthur C. Clarke and some Robert Silverberg. I should say as well that these are available not at the lowest level of joining. They're available to you at the Keeper tier and up. And so, you know, if you are someone who's with us on Patreon at one of those lower tiers, this hopefully will be an incentive for you to think about upgrading your support. And we would, of course, really, really appreciate that.
We certainly would. And these are terrific episodes. Glenn, you've done a great job doing a great reading of these stories and looking at these categories of speculative fiction. And I'm excited to see these keep going on. And we do hope you'll join us at the level you're most comfortable with at Patreon. I think it's well worth your time and money. But let's continue our coverage of the Eye Flash Miracles here today. We left off with Little Tib waking up after a day and a half long fever fugue of sorts in Martinsburg, as we'll find out. And now the plot can really pick up.
Yeah, right. We are in a motel room following Little Tib's levitation and vision. Dr. Prithvi is here now, and he is very interested in what is happening. Now, he believes that something divine is going on here, and he wants to know if Little Tib thought that the lion he danced with in his vision was God. But Tib does not think so. He thinks it was just an angel. Now, Mr. Parker is here as well, and he is skeptical of ascribing any religiosity, any religious meaning to this. I mean, he clearly saw Little Tib levitating as well. He doesn't deny that, but he wants to treat this as a paranormal ability, which is something that he believes in, something that he has read about. And Nitty is also here, and he finally gives voice to something that I think we, the readers, have known the whole time, and something we've been talking about really the whole time, which is that Little Tib is a miracle worker. It's not just the levitation and the girl's leg. Nitty now understands that Tib healed Mr. Parker and also caused that tear gas to just disappear back on the train. But Mr. Parker is skeptical of this. He has some rational explanations. But then it turns out that he thinks that he was only delusional for a few weeks, when in fact, Nitty has been caring for him for 3 years. And this revelation seems to give Mr. Parker some pause.
Yeah, Mr. Parker seems to totally reject any faith where the explanations for the inexplicable rely on anything beyond the limits of rationality. And really anything can be folded into a rational system, including, you know, something like paranormal activity or something like that, as though a hypothesis can be proven through repeated experiments and so on. And we see this in his little conflict, in Mr. Parker's little conflict with Dr. Prithvi. You know, Parker's faith, if you could call it that, is founded upon the rational propositions. And he indicates here in this section, and as we get deeper into the actual heist part of the plot, that everything is reducible to numbers, really, to statistics or spreadsheets or something like that. Numbers which might encompass probabilities and you know, things that a computer could spit out based on rational programming and so on. But Prithvi, on the other hand, is looking for rational propositions, like someone explained to Little Tib about the symbolic imagery on the side of the van that had to do with lions, in order to account for that which so far has no rational explanation. And we see here the early seeds of what I think Wolf has on his mind for this story, which for my money has to do with a question of epistemes and divine revelation. And if you don't know what that means, don't worry, I'll break it down in the discussion episode. And if you do know what it means and you're mad at me for saying it, hopefully I'll convince you that I have a good argument for this being on Wolf's mind. In any event, we also will have to consider what philosophical notions inform Parker's worldview in our discussion. But what we do know is that Wolf bakes into Parker's character the philosophy of mind problem that examines that brain states, sensory information, and memory can be unreliable sources of data about the world. And certainly we ought to rely on them, like normally, for the most part. But in philosophy of mind, what we're dealing with is like a problem of subjectivity versus objectivity versus maybe intersubjectivity or a consensus-based picture of reality. Parker has this subjective position based on his memory and his senses that because it was always warm, it was always summer. And since it was always summer, he can't have been befuddled for more than some weeks. Now, he's wrong about this. And we see in the objective view, based on what we know of Nitti's character, his reliability, his caringness, and so on, along with the information that he provides, that the truth of the matter is that Parker was out of his mind, so to speak, for 3 years. So Parker and Nitti's silence, then, is a moment of intersubjectivity, where Parker has to integrate Nitti's objective information, the facts, along with what that means as Parker was cared for so long, which is going to change Parker's view of himself, which is a subjective judgment to create a new picture of reality. So, you know, we know that Wolf has a lot on his mind about the role that the subjective mind plays in the formation of a picture of reality. Also, maybe I'll want to talk about qualia at some point, and maybe I'll do that in our discussion, but I'll just say for now that what Little Tib is up to during this interaction between Nitti and Mr. Parker is having highly subjective sense-based experiences, you know, like what is it like for Little Tib to be drinking soda? And that's qualia, more or less, right? The sense data that translates, to use a clumsy term, into our overall subjective experience with, you know, whatever we're encountering. And this story has a lot to do with qualia and phenomenology. Glenn, you brought this up in our first episode with the first paragraph being loaded with sensory information, but ignoring sight. And I hesitate to dive too deeply into that pool right now. And maybe even if I do want to dive into it, we'd be best off by staying in shallow waters. So there's one more thing I want to look at here, but Glenn, maybe I'll let you jump in and see what you have to say about, you know, all of this stuff about Parker's mind, sense information, and the way that's playing into the story.
Right. Yeah. You and I do not know what it is like to not have our sight. We don't know what it's like to be blind. I don't know that, you know, Wolf has any experience with that either. I don't know that he ever had any experience, you know, where he'd lost his sight for a few days or something like that. But he is doing what writers are meant to do, and which is to explore what it would be like, what it might be like to be other than one's self. And here he is doing that, trying to envision what it would be like to experience the world without sight, experience the world solely through other senses. And, you know, it may not really line up with the actual experience of blind people, but it is nonetheless, I think, a pretty compelling way of writing. It's really some excellent wordsmithing that at the very least gets me to think about my own senses and the way in which, you know, that I engage with the world and so on. And I really appreciate it for that. And I think similarly, right, this is also how he's writing about Mr. Parker, who is maybe not sense, but his perception of things has been off, has been wrong for a long time. And to be faced with that and to have that, you know, to have to kind of reconcile with that, right, would be, I think, alarming for any of us to experience. I think Wolf is doing a really great job here of showing that to us, letting us empathize with Parker's experience here as well, even as we're, you know, seeing it through the lens of Little Tip.
Yeah, it's tremendous, tremendous bit of writing here as Wolf is trying to draw together these ideas about sensory information, perception of reality, and give us these two different perspectives that show us the unreliability of relying wholly on our own senses and maybe the ways in which we have need for one another to kind of navigate reality. But we also have to really look at the religious element as it becomes more explicit in these moments of the story, and, you know, with the introduction of Dr. Prithvi. You know, first of all, Prithvi, Nidhi, and Parker all believe that Little Tib has some kind of paranormal abilities, and that it's clear then as a reader that this is a perfectly acceptable in-universe explanation for what is going on. And we'll learn more about that as the story continues. The religious element, though, is what's emphasized here. Dr. Prithvi is very interested in what the lion that gave Little Tib that power of levitation might symbolize. And we get some suggestions from Dr. Prithvi about what God might have taken on, you know, the form of the lion, like which God might have taken on the form of the lion is probably the way I should have said that. So I'm going to read from the text here, but I will say first that Dr. Prithvi suggests that the lion man, the lion person, might be Vishnu. One of, if not the supreme being of Hinduism. And now there's some other, a little litany of lion symbols in religion here that I'll read from the text. Among the Jews, it is the emblem of the tribe of Judah. For this reason, the emperor of Ethiopia is styled Lion of Judah. Also, the son-in-law of Muhammad, whose name I cannot recall, now when I need it, was styled Lion of God. Christianity, too, is very rich with lions. You noticed, perhaps, that I asked the boy particularly if the lion he saw had wings. I did that because a winged lion is the badge of Saint Mark. But a lion without wings indicates the Christ. This is the old belief that the cubs of the lion are dead at birth and are licked to life afterward by the lioness. In the writings of Sir C.S. Lewis, a lion is used that way, and in the prayers revealed to St. Bridget of Sweden, the Christ is styled Strong Lion, Immortal and Invincible King. And after Prithvi runs through this list, Nidhi reminds Prithvi of the images of the new creation, where the lion will lay down with the lamb. That's also where we get the imagery about all tears being wiped away and so on, signifying a lack of predation in the world and a harmony of being between all creatures. And also that Christ is just as often depicted, perhaps more importantly, as a lamb in New Testament imagery rather than as a lion. And I think the point of this evaluation of the symbol here is to show how the most powerful animal that people can think of is used to symbolize the highest form of being that we can imagine. It's universal, or at least it's a symbol used a lot if you're doing a comparative religious survey or something like that. But Little Tib, who no one really believes or listens to regarding his own experience, tells us explicitly that the lion is just an angel, probably, and implicitly, if we've been tracking with the Oz stuff, that it was just the cowardly lion, and that whatever spiritual, supernatural, or paranormal forces are aiding Little Tib are using a network of symbols and meaning that are familiar to Tib in order to bring about their own ends. And Nitty has more of a Catholic or broadly Christian theology here, and so thinks about these questions in terms of Christianity. Dr. Prithvi thinks about them in terms of sort of a syncretic religious position. This is a very important point that the text is starting to hone in on again and will feature heavily in our discussion of the story. But I think the thing that we're going to want to talk about the most and spend the most time on in our discussion is just why it is that Gene Wolfe has knighted C.S. Lewis, who rejected his knighthood.
Yes, that really jumped out to me as well. Behind the scenes, I guess, I should let people know that also, you know, in the process of doing these episodes, we, as a network, have done an entire series on the Chronicles of Narnia. Most of that's over on Hanging Out with the Dream King, the Neil Gaiman podcast that I do with Brent Helt, because we were covering some Neil Gaiman, C.S. Lewis, or really Narnia, I guess, fan fiction. And then Jay and I also did an episode on Atos. So I have been deep in C.S. Lewis, reading Narnia over and over again, reading Gaiman's fiction about Narnia, but also reading biographies of C.S. Lewis, reading his scholarship and so on. And so, yeah, this idea, you know, that, well, the story that he had rejected the knighthood, which is, I guess, something people have a lot to say about, actually. Lewis scholars have a lot to say about, partisans in this debate, I guess, understanding what this is. Yeah, this really jumped out to me. I don't know why Wolfe did that. Do you think Wolfe just didn't realize that Lewis hadn't been knighted, or is he making some point here?
I don't know. I feel like he might just be mixed up about information, or he is kind of posthumously knighting Lewis, which would kind of play into this weird sort of Christendom aspect of the text, you know, God's real kingdom or something. I don't know why he knighted Lewis, and we're actually not going to spend any time beyond this conversation talking about it, but it's a fun feature of the text.
Right. Well, and I do think it's worth thinking about just a little bit here, not so much the knighting of Lewis, but the lion as God or lion as Jesus imagery that for anyone born, well, you know, baby boomers and younger, I guess, right? That this is inextricably linked with Narnia. But of course, Lewis wrote these books pretty late in his life, really only about 10 years before he died. And so Wolfe himself didn't read these books when he was a kid. He was, you know, 20 something. I mean, I guess he was in Korea when these books came out, right? So they just, you know, he's obviously read them, or at least is aware of them, but they aren't going to influence his thinking on this in the same way that they do for us, which is actually just kind of a strange, you know, generational mentality to get into, right? To realize that Wolfe's, although he engages so much with all this formative material that we, you know, we all recognize as formative, Tolkien, Robert E. Howard, H.P. Lovecraft, and so on, but Narnia was old for him, or Narnia was new for him, right? That it wasn't a feature of his own childhood, and so doesn't go into this, and doesn't really go into any of the fantasy or fantastical world building that he's done. Is, I don't know, it's kind of shocking to realize.
It is, but we know that he read a ton of C.S. Lewis, or at least like was deep, you know, familiar with Lewis deep cuts, because he used Lewis's distinct translation of, I forget what book now, but in Tracking Song. And so it's like he's engaging with Lewis, but to what degree is, it is an open question. I think the stories that formed Wolfe as a kid are what he relies upon for his network of symbols. And Oz came out in the early 1900s. And so by the time Wolfe was born in the 30s, these would have been sort of the children's books to read.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so it's fun here to see that, you know, even though this in some ways is Gene Wolfe's Oz fan fiction, that he's got some Narnia in here, you know, acknowledging, right, that this would have been the reference that I guess would have mattered more to his own kids, I suppose, right? Which is also something else that you and I are going to have to be dealing with soon.
Yeah, I'm not excited to be reading troves of YA fiction along with my kids, but If they're listening, if they do come across this episode and hear me say that, never mind. I absolutely loved it. Loved every second of it.
Well, I think you and I are going to have to start a podcast called Glenn and Brandon Reluctantly Read YA Fiction with Their Kids, but It's fine. We love you.
Yeah, I think that's the right title for it.
All right. Well, let's go get some plot here. So they are more or less in Martinsburg now. And so it's time to, finally, I should say, time to break into the county administration building so that Mr. Parker can use the computer to get his job back and get Nitty's job back as well. And they need a little tip for that. Now, Mr. Parker has already scouted out the window with the bars, and he believes that Tib can fit through these bars, open the window, and then go find a key for a door that is padlocked from the outside. And that then will be the extent of Tib's involvement, because at that point, Nitty will bring him back here, because Dr. Prithvi is going to put on a kind of pageant, and Tib has a role to play. So that's the plan, and now it's time to execute that plan. A little Tib gets inside, just as planned, but once he's inside, things are not as they expected, which that's how every heist story has to go, of course, right? But what they didn't expect is that there's a person here. Now, really, this person is just some padded clothing with a painted face at the top. I think a scarecrow is what we should be imagining here, and we should note that little Tib can see him. Now, the clothes man helps little Tib navigate the building, but the layout does not seem to quite correspond with what Mr. Parker had told him to expect. Now, the clothes man offers to just go get the keys for Tib, but Tib does not want him to do that because he's afraid that the clothes man won't come back. In fact, what he's afraid of is that the clothes man isn't real. But there's no time to dwell on that because there is still another person in here. It's a person with a voice, and here I'm quoting, like big stones grinding together at the bottom of the deepest hole in the world. Now, it's not really a person, or at least it's not anthropomorphic, right? Who this is the computer. Now, Tib is afraid of it, but the clothes man tells Tib that the computer is just as afraid of him, and so you just don't go in that room. But Tib does go in that room, and he has to face his fear, and he succeeds, even as the computer tries really, really hard to frighten him. And that's it. Now the clothes man gets the keys and comes back, and Tib passes them on to Mr. Parker and Nitty. And now it's time to go be in a pageant.
The section here really is the culmination of the plot that little Tib stepped into when he met Nitty and Mr. Parker. And in many ways, then, this is the most perfunctory portion of the story. It had to happen because it's been hinted at from very early on. But little Tib is more than just a background character in Mr. Parker's story, though I think Mr. Parker will almost certainly think of him in that way as time goes on. And this section has more explicit narrative elements to it that are borrowed from the New Testament Gospels. For one, we've got the scarecrow as little Tib's guide through this, you know, I don't know, database building or like computer housing, some kind of administration building. And, you know, I said, you know, what does that have to do with the Gospels, right? The scarecrow does not show up in any of the four canonical Gospels. But for one, you know, we have to mention this moment where the scarecrow tells a fearful and doubting George that he shouldn't be afraid and that George can touch the scarecrow in order to be assured that the scarecrow is real. And this is reminiscent of Christ's imploring with his disciple Thomas, who didn't believe in Christ's resurrection until he could touch the wounds of Jesus. So it's this moment of doubt where doubt is expunged through touch. The next gospel-connected moment we see is the scarecrow, though this is maybe a little more ambiguous, or someone casting out the voices in the computer who call themselves Legion. And again, this is a scene taken from at least two of the Gospels where Jesus heals a demon-possessed man by casting out the demons within the man who call themselves Legion, for they are many, and they're cast out into a herd of pigs who then run and die in the sea, run off a cliff. you know, plus on an abstract level, you have the imagery of the scarecrow hanging on a post. But I think maybe Wolf might have been too clever here by half, or, you know, by not using the name Scarecrow from Oz, or he wanted to avoid copyright infringement. I'm not sure when these stories would have been, the copyright would have been up, certainly sometime around the 70s, but it's hard to say. Maybe with the movie, it's even harder to say. I don't know. Whatever. I guess it's also worth mentioning or making a note of Tibbs' fear of the computer network that he has to encounter. And so what we see is this text associating this computer with demonology. And Tip has a genuine fear of this kind of technology that I think maybe we'll see more reasons why Tip fears technology as the story comes to its conclusion. But as we've seen, Wolf is interested in understanding this kind of techno-authoritarian or totalitarian state rooted in the promise of technological progress, bureaucratic efficiency, and the perfect objectivity that comes from these sorts of impersonal systems ruling the world.
Well, this is one of the things that I love about Wolf, generally speaking, right, is his ability to blend these technological anxieties, technological concerns that really are the purview of science fiction, but then to talk about them, write about them, also in the language of fantasy at the same time. I can't think of another writer who not only does this as well as Gene Wolfe, but even really attempts to do this the way that Gene Wolfe does. It's something that I think is really magnificent. And here we have it on full display. Thinking about the copyright of Oz, I imagine that all of these character names are still copyrighted here. I didn't really think too much about that before, but, you know, we tend to think back to, you know, when was the book published? Okay, what's, you know, what's the countdown clock for that? But I think that every time anything new is created, right, in any way, that the copyright on these things gets renewed. And that's actually probably a motivator for the copyright owner to make sure that there's an Oz movie every 15 years or something like that.
Right,
and so,
right.
Yeah, because it like resets that clock, right? So these are all probably still copyrighted here. So yeah, Wolf almost certainly couldn't have used them, because I would imagine at this point in the 70s, the copyright owner would have been pretty, litigious about that at this point. I hadn't considered that as part of the reality of actually trying to write some Oz fan fiction without really ever using any of the names.
Yeah, I mean, that's totally true. I think these stories were written long after Baum stopped writing them as well, and so yeah, they're still in, maybe not in the public domain yet. But regarding your questions of technology and fantasy and myth, the only other person I can think of who was doing this was Zelazny, right? So you got like Wolf and Zelazny, kind of as the two main people, not afraid to have like cat people typing on computers, you know? And we need more of that in our speculative fiction landscape. I think it's gotten a little too monotonous out there. I don't know. That's just my take.
Yeah, well, I think that's something that we could complain about for a long time. So I will move us on here, although not for long, because we need to get some information, I think, for our conversation that is really going to be external to the text. But following this episode, there is this pageant, and the pageant is going to reenact the story of the god Krishna and the god Indra. And Dr. Prithvi does tell us a little of it, but we do not get the whole thing because little Tib stops listening, right? But I do think it would serve us well to have that story. So Brandon, can you share that with me, share that with listeners before we move on here?
Right. Well, Prithvi in the text starts by telling us about Krishna. And Krishna is the eighth avatar of Vishnu, the supreme god of Hinduism. And Krishna, when he is born, is hidden away by his mother, Devaki, whose brother is King Kamsa. Now, Kamsa was given a prophecy that one of Devaki's children would be the cause of his death or put him to death. So Kamsa does what all tyrannical kings who fear death do, and he kills all of Devaki's children as she's, you know, becomes pregnant and gives birth to them. But when Krishna was born, Devaki is able to get Krishna to safety by swapping him with a villager's infant. It's kind of a reverse Moses situation mixed up with some plot stuff from Oedipus. these stories all came before those ones, though. So that's how that story begins. And that's what we get from the text, right? We get this sort of Moses-y in imagery, if we're going to rely on cultural translations here, which I'm going to do more of, and it will be very clumsy, and I hope you'll forgive me. The stuff concerning Indra comes a bit later into the lore surrounding Krishna, and it really has to do with Indra, the king of the Devas. He controls storms, so he's like a Thor or a Zeus kind of archetype, and Indra gets mad at mankind and wants to do them some harm. So he causes it to rain a lot, which threatens the human population. And Krishna saves the people by lifting a mountain with his finger, Mount Govardhana. And the human population shelters under the mountain until Indra chills out a little bit, and then the weather subsides. So I think what's important to note here, and what I think Wolf has in mind, again, is a kind of comparative religion study or syncretism that cannot escape certain types of stories that are present throughout, Christianity and Hinduism, at least, not to mention the Greek myths. We've got a king of all spiritual and supernatural beings who controls the weather, but then we've got a being who is above all of that, who comes to earth in the form of a man and is able to save people from judgment and so on. We have images of the son usurping the father in some ways, the shelter of the father as well. And this son-father stuff, this Oedipal stuff, is going to become more apparent in a bit in the eye flash miracles, but I should say that Krishna is just a really big deal in Hinduism. He was also a shepherd, a kind of pastoral figure, as well as being the supreme being above all beings as an avatar of Vishnu. There's also this mountain imagery, which we saw earlier with the giantess as one of the mothers of the multiple mothers of Little Tib. So just almost too much to talk about here. Just imagery crammed here that maybe if you didn't know the story, the wolf does spell it out fairly clearly. You might not pick up some of the references he drops a little bit later on in the text.
Yeah, it's an interesting move that Wolf interrupts the story or doesn't give us the complete story, but he does give us enough to make sense of what he's attempting to do with it. And so in that way, it's actually quite a clever move, right? To not just say, okay, here's all the backstory you, the reader, is going to need. So let me give you 10 pages of that and then come back to the story, right? Which, of course, is what we have done here in our episode, more or less, is to structure it that way. But that's terrible storytelling. It might be fine radio, but it's terrible storytelling. So Wolf has done, I think, a pretty clever trick in getting around that problem. Something else that he's done, of course, that's really fun is that he has Dr. Prithvi commenting on a lot of this as well. In fact, doing similar things that you're doing here, commenting on parallels that these Hindu stories have with stories that Western readers are going to be more familiar with. So like Greek and Norse mythology, Abrahamic religions, and so on, and making those connections. And presumably that's how Wolf got interested in this material to begin with, though I don't know that for sure, but it is, it's been a fascination of English-speaking people really since the East India Company took over India in the 18th century, right? Realizing that a lot of Indian culture has real parallels in European culture. And in fact, even realizing that the languages are all part of one large language group, the Indo-European language group. This has led scholars now for centuries to think about how old these stories are, try to piece together original forms of these stories that our linguistic and cultural ancestors would have been telling to each other, in the area around the north part of the Caspian Sea, 20,000 years ago and that sort of thing. And you can see, Wolf has a real interest in deep time and unwritten human traditions and so on. We talked a lot about that in the Fifth Head of Cerberus. And so you can see him having some fun with that here as well.
Yeah, exactly. And I think Wolf is getting this from Kipling, number one, probably his first introduction to this sort of thing. And I'm going to stick by my hypothesis that Wolf read The Two Hands of God by Alan Watts and gave him a deeper understanding of, if not syncretism, this sort of comparative religious study of similarities and at least Jungian archetypes that can be abstracted out of these similar elements between different world religions.
Right. And just refresher for listeners, of course, that was really important for your reading of Peace. We talked about for a long time in our Peace wrap-up episodes. Well, we've got one more part here that we need to do today. It's actually a pretty big chunk of story that we need to recap. And really, it's another story within the story while Tib is waiting for the pageant to get started. Now, the teller of the story here is the person who is playing the part of Indra. And, you know, Tib can't see this person, right? So what we get is this person's voice. And this person has a deep voice, also has a funny accent. And when Tib asks about the accent, this person says that he's from Niagara, which is the capital of this nation. And this story is about experiments in genetically engineering humans. So there are some scientists who did something to some women. These women were mostly school teachers. That the scientists thought would make their children smarter and stronger. But in order to properly study these children to see if the engineering had worked, the scientists needed a control group, that is to say, a group of children who had not been genetically engineered. And people volunteered to give up their kids. These were farmers and ranchers and factory workers, which is to say, people who needed the money. And then the scientists observed these kids for several years. And the deal is that all sorts of strange stuff happened in this facility, mostly involving animals. For example, animals just started showing up in the compound without having gotten into the compound from the outside. And there were laboratory animals in the compound as well, and those were found to be outside their cages, without the cages themselves having been opened. And so the genetic engineering seems to have created some X-Men, apparently, or at least created one X-Men. Now, the scientists tried really hard to figure out which children or which child was doing this, and they even created a new retinal scan in order to try to identify people with paranormal abilities, but they didn't find anybody. And this really worried the government at the highest levels. I mean, the president just didn't want a bunch of X-Men running around. And so in the end, the government killed all of these children who had been genetically engineered so that they would not become a threat and so that their brains could be studied. But the story takes a turn here. To use their new retinal scan, the scientists had really just modified a system that was already in use with scanners around the country. And so the system is now in use everywhere with this modification. And what they had modified was the system for identifying escaped prisoners. And that system would blind the fugitives so that they would be easier to apprehend. And then one day the detector went off, right? What I mean here is that someone with paranormal abilities had been scanned, but because this type of scan destroys a person's retinas, that's what happened here as well. And since that scan destroyed the person's retinas, the person would never be able to be scanned again. And so it would be difficult to locate this person. Still, they had the records of people who had been scanned at the same time and place. And what they found was that they were looking for a kid who had actually been a part of this genetic engineering experiment, but not one of the genetically engineered kids because, right, they had all been killed. So rather, who this kid is one of the kids who had been part of the control group. Though really, what they surmise is that one of the mothers swapped babies because she was worried about, well, she was worried about exactly what did come to pass. She was worried that eventually the genetically engineered kids would be killed or harmed in some way. Now, Indra, or you know, this person who is going to play Indra in the pageant, says that he knows that little Tib is that child. And little Tib knows that he can't escape this person. And so he just asks if the man is going to kill him now. And the answer is, not now, but soon. And then the door of the bus opens and Nitty is there. And that's where we'll stop today.
We have here, you know, the explanation, at least for some of this two-mother business and the way that the mothers represent different classes in society and so on. And that's an incredible touch. There's a lot to go over here at the end, actually. And I'll just begin by saying what I want to say here. Wolf, I think, is gracious enough to have to us as readers to have Little Tib recognize immediately the parallel between the story he's being told about mothers and paranormal children and the tale that we just went over about Krishna or the birth of Jesus. He wonders if that's the story being told explicitly. You know, so what are we supposed to make of this parallel? What is Wolf pointing out about the conditions under which messianism can occur? And I think that's best saved for the discussion. But for now, it will suffice to just point it out that it's an explicit question raised for the text, the kind of discursive positions, material conditions under which people can believe in the supernatural or a messiah. Another thing we're dealing with in the text is transhumanism and technological progressivism. We've brought this up in the past. There's certainly socioeconomic impacts of technological progressivism on Wolf's mind here as he considers how Americanology rooted in individualism, capitalism as an large economic model, the Protestant work ethic, bootstrapping, and so on, how all that might play out in the face of a technological revolution where the pace of technological development and progress outstrips the worker's ability to match skills or efficiency. And I also think Wolf is prodding the reader to consider, like, what problem technological optimism or this sort of technological revolution is actually even trying to address. Like, what is it a solution for? Or is it just an ideology that is meant to console or salve our anxieties about the world? And again, these are going to be big topics in our discussion episode. The second to last thing I want to say here is that we are beginning to see, or maybe we've seen already, a collection of wolfisms here in the text, namely the use of a play or theatrical production as a cover for criminal activity. We see this in Fifth Ed of Cerberus and returns in Book of the New Sun. It's all over the place. Wolf has a real love of theatricality and pulp plots, and it's just on display here, and I love it. Like, I love that this is a thing that Wolf returns to time and time again.
Yeah, we also have a heist story here that Wolf uses also elsewhere in the solar cycle.
Absolutely. I mean, this is a very important text, I think, if you're studying Wolf in any sort of way. The last thing I want to say here is that nearly all of these big questions that I'm talking about are the focus of at least the early seasons of Fringe, the TV series, which, if you're not familiar with it, is a kind of post 9/11 answer to the X-Files. Has a lot to do with paranormal children, and there's also some Trojan War stuff thrown in there for good measure. Also, Gene Wolfe is mentioned in at least one episode of Fringe, though it's not the eye flash miracles that people are seeking. It is the Book of the Long Sun, still kind of a deep cut for non-Wolfe readers or people only familiar with Wolfe through New Sun. So that's my pitch for Fringe today, and makes me want to go watch it because, I don't know, Cortexa fan isn't eye flash miracle stuff, but it's still pretty cool concept, technologically produced paranormal children. I never get tired of that. It's such a cool idea, and Wolf's doing it really well here. So does Fringe.
Yeah, you and I were really into Fringe when it aired, but then after that, I never watched it again. It's one of the few TV shows that I really, really liked that I never, ever revisited. You and I talk about it from time to time, and someday we should just do a Fringe show, you know, a single episode on maybe the whole run of Fringe. I don't know when we'll do that. The 2050s, I think, at this point.
2050s, we'll do, we'll pick an X-Files episode and we'll do the Fringe version of it. And we'll talk about pre and post 9/11 government paranoia and overreach and so on. And I think 2050s is the right time to do that.
Yeah, I think 60 years after the X-Files has been on the air is exactly the right time for us to do that episode. Well, I think that then is going to do it for today. I'm Glenn McDorman.
And I'm Brandon Buddha. You can find us and all our other creative projects, as always, at claytemplemedia.com. I hope you'll join us on Patreon for Glenn's Easter and Earth Day episodes, our new series of holiday episodes looking at speculative fiction and religion. and speculative fiction and the climate. Next time, we'll be back with our final recap episode of the iFlash Miracles. And until then, we greet you and say farewell.